In the final analysis, the only real evidence, that is, the only real scientific evidence we have about the origin of anything, is the fossil record itself. All other evidence is evidence that can be derived by inference. But concerning the real solid evidence of what has actually happened in the past, we must go to the fossil record. The fossil record, you see, is the history of past forms of life. So it does tell us something about what has existed on the earth in the past. And that is what we're trying to determine here in this question of creation and evolution. What really did happen in the past as far as the origins of plants and animals and other forms of life are concerned? Now let us ask ourselves, first of all, the question, what would we expect to find in the fossil record if evolution is true? On the other hand, what would we expect to find in the fossil record if creation is true? Well, of course, we have to have a firm idea of the mechanisms involved. In the case of evolution, certainly, and we ought to understand what we mean by creation. Of course, by creation, we are referring to the concept or truth, as I accept it, that our universe and all that it contains were brought into being by the direct acts of God, the Creator. That God created certain basic kinds of plants and animals. And that these kinds were essentially, as we find them today, right from the beginning. Oh, there has been minor changes, limited changes since creation. But basically, the categories of plants and animals were established from the beginning. The created kinds. For example, we have the dog kind. Now, starting with the mongrel dog, the wild dog, man has selected for certain genetic characteristics, and by selection and inbreeding, he has enhanced certain of these genetic characteristics, so that today we have almost 200 varieties of dogs, all the way from the 4-pound Chihuahua to the 180-pound Great Dane. But they're all dogs. They're all interfertile. They're all one basic kind. Furthermore, since the dog, our common household pet, Canis familiaris, can and does interbreed on occasion with coyotes and with wolves and with jackals, it seems to us reasonable to conclude that the jackals, the dogs, coyotes, and wolves were all derived from one created kind. Now, they are classified as different species. This is because that they do not ordinarily interbreed. Ordinarily, they remain separate and do not interbreed. So, we have arbitrarily placed them in different species. But since they can and do interbreed, it seems to us reasonable to conclude that they arose from the original created kind, which we might call the dog kind. There has been this amount of variation. I hesitate to use the word change, because all the genes were there to begin with. They had been created, this gene pool had been created, but it was created with sufficient potential, genetic potential, potential for variation, that these varieties or species have arisen since the beginning. So we want to emphasize now that in our creation model, we speak of the fixity of kinds, but not the fixity of species. There is a variation within the limits of the kind. The variation is strictly limited. Certainly, we can say there is no evidence in the present world or in the world of the past that cats and dogs have arisen from a common ancestor, as evolutionists postulate. Furthermore, we can say among the reptile kind that the lizards, crocodiles, snakes, animals of this kind have always been separate and distinct. They have not arisen from a common ancestor. So that we are able to recognize the basic kinds. That is, in most cases. So we recognize then the fact that God has created these basic categories of plants and animals, none of which have arisen from common ancestors. one from the other, but they were each basically distinctly created. Now we compare our creation model to the evolution model, which tells us that by inherent natural properties, an evolutionary process beginning with simple chemicals has taken place whereby life arose from non-life, and then all living things have arisen or evolved from this first living form of life. Now this process was strictly natural, strictly mechanistic. No supernatural force, no creator was involved. All of this was due to properties inherent in matter. And all living things are interrelated because of this continuous evolutionary process of which began with a single living thing. This process we call the general theory of evolution. Sometimes it's called the particles to people theory, the amoeba to man theory. And I sometimes call it the fish to gish theory of evolution. So we understand then very clearly what we are talking about by this term evolution. We're not talking about, you know, merely genetic change through time. There is genetic change through time. The next generation of human beings is going to be somewhat different than this one. They're going to have a different genetic combination. My children do not have the same genetic combination that I have. I'm very pleased about that. They're a lot better looking than I am. And, of course, there is always the possibility that we'll suffer mutations, these crippling conditions. That's genetic change through time, but that's not what we mean by evolution. We're talking about this idea, this concept that all living things have come from one single living thing by this slow, gradual process. Now, the evolutionary process, which is accepted by practically all evolutionists today, envisions a very, very slow and gradual evolutionary change. Change, it comes through the accumulation of micromutations. The mutations which have contributed to evolutionary change bring about very, very slight changes, most of which would actually be imperceptible. They're so slight. Therefore, it would require the accumulation of thousands upon thousands of these micromutations through thousands of generations, hundreds of thousands of years, to bring about the basic changes required. So the very essence of evolution is slow and gradual change. Now, if this has taken place then, we can see, I think, what we'd expect to find in the fossil record. The oldest rocks which contain fossils ought to contain fossils of very simple forms of life. That is, the simplest form of life capable of leaving a fossil record. Then as we search out what are supposed to be younger and younger strata, we ought to find, as a matter of fact, we must find a slow, gradual change of simple forms into more and more complex forms of life. And if a single form of life, or at the most a very few, have given rise to the millions of species that now exist and have existed in the past, then the rock should produce a tremendous number of transition forms, the intermediate forms. They've got to be there. There's just no way about it. They have to be. Millions of species evolving through hundreds of millions of years through innumerable transitional stages would leave countless billions times billions of intermediate forms. For example, the fish that supposedly evolved as an amphibian over 30 million years of time. While the number of intermediate forms that actually lived and died during all this evolution would number in the billions times billions and perhaps times billions again. Vast numbers of these creatures would have lived and died during all those 30 million years. Now, all we have to do is find three or four as fossils scattered through time, and that would be sufficient to document evolution, wouldn't it? I know that fossilization is extremely rare under present conditions and under the assumed uniformitarian conditions that evolutionists say have existed in the past. Of course, fossilization would be rare. It would require a catastrophe of some kind. The amazing thing is, by the way, is the fact that we do find billions of fossils. In the Karoo Formation of South Africa alone, it has been estimated if you could dig out every one of those fossils, you could produce 800 billion vertebrate fossils. I'm not talking about little marine invertebrates. I'm talking about reptiles and things like that. Think of it, 800 billion. It seems to indicate conditions have been quite different in the past and quite catastrophic. But nevertheless, even if fossilization is extremely rare, because of the vast stretches of time involved and the supposed billions times billions of these things that lived and died, all we'd have to do is find a very insignificant fraction of the fossils that did, or the creatures that did become fossils, and they'd have to be a most insignificant fraction of all the creatures that ever lived and died. And there would be literally thousands of these intermediate forms in our museums. Our museums should be full of intermediate forms and transitional forms. As a matter of fact, it shouldn't be hard to find transitional forms. It'd be difficult not to find transitional forms. As you dig down the earth, perhaps at that particular strata, which would represent supposedly a particular time, you would find the terminal form of one animal. Maybe he'd been evolving for, say, 50 million years. Now he'd reached the terminal stage, so he was now stable. But at that same time, you see, according to evolutionary theory, there were many other animals still in the process of evolution. So as you dig down and dig up this strata and find the types of life that were supposed to have been in existence at that time, you couldn't help but find transitional forms. Indeed, our museum should be full of these intermediate forms if evolution has really taken place. But now if creation is true, then we expect a very different picture. If creation is true, we'd expect an abrupt appearance of a great variety of highly complex plants and animals for which we could find no evolutionary ancestors. When I say abrupt, I mean all of a sudden, here they are complete. In other words, the first time you see a bat, he's a bat. First time you see a fish, he's a fish. First time you see a turtle, he's a typical turtle. First time you see a triceratops dinosaur, he's a triceratops dinosaur. First time you see man, he's man. Now that's what we'd expect on the basis of creation, the abrupt appearance of tremendous varieties of highly complex forms of life, no evolutionary ancestors. And we'd expect to find the sudden appearance of the fossils of the different kinds of organisms, but no transitional form. Now that's what we must find if creation is true. Now, I don't know what's wrong with those predictions. That's certainly what we would expect. If we're postulating this evolutionary theory and didn't have any idea what was actually in those rocks, that's what you certainly would predict and expect. Now, we see the predictions are very different, aren't they? The predictions you make on the basis of creation are extremely different than the predictions you make on the basis of evolution. Now, we've got our two models. We've got our predictions. Now, wouldn't you think it would be a rather simple thing to dig down into the rocks and produce the fossils, and then after some years of study and classification and so forth, to decide on the basis of the actual evidence which is true, creation or evolution? That ought to be a simple thing, wouldn't it? I mean, it's not just one shade of gray versus another. It's black versus white, night versus day. They're so different. Well, we're just going to take a look at that fossil record now and see what it shows. I think the choice is that easy. I think the choice is very easy. Decide which model is correct on the basis of the predictions made. I'm going to let you decide now on the basis of the evidence that is available. Now, first of all, concerning the general nature of the fossil record, I want to quote some several sources. Now, people often accuse us creationists of being selective in our quotations. Yes, no question about it, we are. I never quote from a creationist, for example. I'm very selective in that respect. I quote only from evolutionists. Then we quote significant papers. Some of the most significant papers, of course, papers written by evolutionists in which they make these damaging admissions. Now, what was it that was responsible for bringing down Nixon at Watergate? Was it the accusations of his political enemies? No. Was it those statements by his friends who were supporting him? No. It was statements by a few people on his White House staff that said, now look, fellas, here's the way it really is. Here's the way it really was. And that is what was really significant. And what's really significant in the literature, statements by avowed evolutionists who frankly say, fellas, this is the way it is. And that's what we're going to use today, the literature from evolutionists that really tells it like it really is. The first paper I want to cite is that by James W. Valentine and Catherine Camel in American Scientist, Volume 63, 1975, beginning on page 673. Now, these two evolutionists are proposing some ideas that are rather revolutionary in evolutionary thinking. I don't have time to describe the particular mechanism or suggestions that they are making, but they're rather radical departures from usual thinking in evolution. But what I want to call your attention this afternoon is the reasons why they thought some radical thinking or rethinking was necessary. What had forced this? What had suggested, perhaps, that the present ideas were incorrect? Well, let me read the first paragraph in that paper. Beginning on page 673 with the very first sentence, Valentine and Camel say, quote, the abrupt appearance of higher taxa in the fossil record has been a perennial puzzle. Not only do characteristic and distinctive remains of phyla appear suddenly, without known ancestors, but several classes of a phylum, orders of a class, and so on, commonly appear at approximately the same time without known ancestors or without known intermediates. Darwin recognized that such gaps presented a major obstacle to demonstrating that evolution proceeded by the slow accumulation of change within lineages. He attributed the lack of antecedents to the incompleteness of the fossil record. Over 100 years later, we still face the problem of missing ancestors of many higher taxa. Indeed, our present knowledge of the fossil record demonstrates even more clearly the episodic nature of the origin of new higher taxa. Unquote. All right, what are these people saying? There's a perennial puzzle for evolution. Characteristic and distinctive remains of phyla appear suddenly without ancestors. These different kinds appear abruptly without intermediate forms. There's these gaps you see in the fossil record between these different kinds. This has been a perennial puzzle for evolutionists. But of course, no puzzle for creationists. This is precisely the evidence that we'd expect and did predict, and would predict on the basis of creation. Now, in case someone thinks that Valentine and Camel have overstated the case somewhat, let me quote from a paper published by Dr. David B. Kitts of the University of Oklahoma. This article was published in the journal Evolution, volume 28, 1974, beginning on page 458. Now, Kitts is an evolutionist. There's no doubt about it. He received his training under George Gaylord Simpson in paleontology, and of course Simpson's one of the world's most famous evolutionists. And Dr. Kitts happens to be one of the two evolutionists that my colleague, Dr. Morris, and I debated on the campus of the University of Oklahoma several years ago. And during that debate, we were emphasizing the gaps in the fossil record, the lack of intermediate forms. And Kitts turned to us during the debate and said, well, the gaps are real, and they are a problem. Now, several years after the debate, we find this article published by Dr. Kitts called Paleontology and Evolutionary Theory. So he's discussing the subject of the fossil record in the light of evolutionary theory. Listen to what he has to say on page 467. He says, quote, despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. Unquote. So notice that Kitt says the evolutionary theory requires intermediate forms, but the fossil record does not provide them. Now, some of my evolutionary friends or people we debate when they talk about all these transitional forms and evidence and deny the gaps in the fossil record, why I just bring out this article and quote it and I say, now, wait a minute. If it wasn't true, why did Kitt say so? He's a very knowledgeable paleontologist. He is an evolutionist. He published the article in the journal Evolution. There's no hint at all that he wanted to help creation. Why did he say this if it weren't true? And if there are these transitional forms, why don't you sit down and write a letter to Kitt and tell him about all these transitional forms so he wouldn't be making such silly statements and embarrassing himself in the University of Oklahoma. Well, even Simpson has admitted that gaps between the higher categories, the phyla, the classes, and the orders, are systematic and almost always large. Oh, if you would go up to Simpson and ask him about it, he said, yes, there's plenty of transitional forms. Well, I don't know what transitional forms he's talking about. Certainly not between the higher categories, the kinds that we would believe to be the created kinds. For he himself admitted the gaps there are systematic and almost always large. What about the fossil record of the plants? Well, that's really a sad case. Let me quote from an article published by Dr. E.J. H. Corner, a botanist at the University of Cambridge. Corner is an evolutionist. He's not willing to accept creation. He is an advocate of the evolutionary philosophy. But in the book, Contemporary Botanical Thought, edited by McLeod and Cobley, published by Quadrangle Books of Chicago in 1961, we find that Corner has authored the chapter called Evolution. And on page 97 of that chapter, we find the following statement. Dr. Corner says, quote, "Much evidence can be adduced in favor of the theory of evolution from biology, biogeography, and paleontology. But I still think that to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of spatial creation." Unquote. So Corner admits that the fossil record actually does not favor evolution, but it favors creation. Now why does he say this? He says this because the major plant kinds appear in the fossil record abruptly, with no ancestors and with no transitional form. For example, Darwin called the origin of flowering plants that abominable mystery. And in 1976, to evolutionists, the origin of flowering plants still an abominable mystery. 49 families of flowering plants appear in the fossil record with no ancestors and with no intermediate form. No evolutionist can go to the fossil record and tell you where flowering plants came from. And that's true of all the major plant kinds. As a matter of fact, evolutionists have always said, or have said for many, many years, that the simple plants evolved in the lower Devonian, that the transition from water to land was made by very simple plants in lower Devonian time, supposedly about 200 million years after the beginning of the Cambrian. And then in the middle Devonian, the more complex plants, such as horsetails, evolved, and by the upper Devonian, vascular plants, woody plants, had evolved. And this is what you find taught in most colleges and universities to this day. Well, over 15 years ago, Leclerc, a Belgian paleontologist, published an article in the journal Evolution in which she reported that the spores of vascular plants had been found many different genera of vascular plants had been found in Cambrian rocks from various places around the world. And in 1959, 3 years later, Dr. Daniel Axelrod, American paleontologist, now at the University of California, Davis, published an article in the same journal in which he cited the evidence from many sources for the discovery of the spores of these vascular plants, not only the spores, but fragments of vascular plants in Cambrian rocks, from workers in the Baltic and in Russia, groups of workers in India and places like that. Multiple reports. And Axelrod stated his belief that it was established that vascular plants had been in existence in the Cambrian. And that's 200 million years, supposedly, before they were even supposed, even before simple plants supposedly had evolved. And since you find the spores of 60 genera in Cambrian rocks, then Axelrod was felt forced to postulate a polyphyletic origin of vascular plants from some unknown algal ancestors way back in pre-Cambrian. Of course, you find absolutely not a trace of any such plants in the so-called pre-Cambrian rocks. All of a sudden, here's this tremendous variety of plants and no ancestors and no intermediate form. And so, the record of plants is a real mess for evolutionists. And then finally, to emphasize the general nature of the fossil record, once again, I want to quote from another evolutionist, from Dr. R.B. Goldschmidt. Now, I like to use this because Goldschmidt was a most remarkable evolutionist. He was quite an exception. He did not believe in slow and gradual evolution. Now, he was a very strong evolutionist. He says that evolution is a fact for which no further proof is needed. Then he just proceeds to demolish the theory of evolution in the article that he's written and the book that he wrote, because he could not accept the idea of slow and gradual evolution, the neo-Darwinian theory of evolution. He couldn't accept that. Now, that is what accepted by practically every evolutionist, 99.99% or more. So in rejecting that, what Goldschmidt is doing is practically rejecting the whole theory of evolution. Not quite. Because he has suggested an alternative mechanism for evolution. Instead of this idea of very, very slow and gradual evolution, whereby one species requires several tens of thousands of years or so to evolve into another, and some say the fish took 30 million years to evolve an amphibian, and a reptile took many millions of years to evolve into a bird, Goldschmidt said it didn't happen that way at all. Now, first of all, let me emphasize why he felt forced to admit that it didn't happen that way. He says, now look, fellas, here's the gaps in the fossil record. They're systematic. The major kinds in plants and animals appear abruptly in the fossil record, instantaneously, without any transitional form. He says, now that evidence just doesn't fit this idea of slow and gradual evolution. Well, Goldschmidt was not about to give up the faith and become a creationist. So he suggests an alternative mechanism that he called the hopeful monster mechanism. Goldschmidt suggested, for example, that at one time a reptile laid an egg. And guess what? A bird came crawling out of that reptilian egg. Just like that. And he said, now every time you see one of these big gaps, that's what happened. Something laid an egg and something else got born. Well, now let me point out, first of all, what a shock that must have been to Mama Reptile. I mean, in good faith, you lay a good reptilian egg and some strange critter like that comes crawling out of that egg. What a shock. Probably would have been a greater shock to Papa Reptile. Can you imagine what thoughts were going around in his mind? I think he would have sued her for divorce, don't you? Claiming infidelity. Well, the neo-Darwinists, the people who believe in slow and gradual evolution, they didn't think he had a better idea either. They didn't think that Goldschmidt had a better idea. Fact is, they think he's the one that laid the egg. And they say there's not a shred of evidence to support his hopeful monster mechanism. Well, Goldschmidt says that's right. No one has ever seen anything like this happen. But he says that's cheap criticism because neither has anyone ever seen one animal slowly and gradually evolve into another. No one has ever seen that either. Well, of course, we agree with both Goldschmidt and the neo-Darwinists because no one has ever seen any kind of evolution. But Goldschmidt was a most avowed evolutionist. He would have been delighted to have museums full of transitional forms. He certainly would admit a transitional form was a transitional form if one existed. But now concerning the fossil record, listen to what Goldschmidt had to say, found in this article published in American Scientist, Volume 40, January of 1952. Now, notice that we've used articles dating from 1952 right up until 1975 in documenting the fossil record. Goldschmidt says on page 97 concerning the fossil record, quote, "The facts of greatest general importance are the following. When a new phylum, class, or order appears, there follows a quick explosive, in terms of geological time, diversification, so that practically all orders or families known appear suddenly and without any apparent transitions," unquote. So Goldschmidt says, phyla, classes, orders, and down to and including practically every family appear in the fossil record abruptly without intermediate forms. Now, I don't suppose we could do much better job than that in describing the fossil record that we would expect if creation is true. This is the actual description of the fossil record by an evolutionist. A little later on that same page, Dr. Goldschmidt says, quote, "Moreover, within the slowly evolving series, like the famous horse series, the decisive steps are abrupt, without transitions," unquote. Oh, there are different kinds of horses. Surely, or were different kinds of horses. But as Dr. Goldschmidt has said, they appear abruptly, without the intermediate form. You have the so-called browsing horses that eat foliage, like the deer. There were the grazing horses that eat grass. They have distinctive kinds of teeth, but you do not find a series of transitional forms showing the change of grazing teeth into browsing teeth. And there is, for example, the three-toed horse and the one-toed horse, but you do not find the intermediate form showing one changing into the other. And there are some places, for example, in the John Day country of Oregon, where you find the three-toed horse and the one-toed horse in the same strata. And evolutionists have scoured the earth and got one horse here and one horse there from different places and different times and arranged them in a sequence supposed to represent the evolution of horses. And it all looks so convincing. But it's really not that convincing at all. Well, now we see the general nature of the fossil record. What is the general nature of the fossil record? Well, these kinds appear abruptly without intermediate form. The lack of transitional forms is so pronounced that Kitt says fossil record does not produce them. He doesn't say that, too bad, fossil record produces only a few transitional forms. He says that it does not produce any. And certainly we can say without fear of contradiction, the gaps in the fossil record between the higher categories are systematic. All right, now that's the general nature of the fossil record. Now let's take a look at some of the examples of these gaps. Now, the evolutionists assume that the Cambrian rocks, the so-called Cambrian rocks, were composed of sediment that was laid down beginning about 600 million years ago. Now they assume this sedimentary material very slowly came out of the water, precipitated, over a vast stretch of time, and how all these things just lay there and waited to become fossils. By this slow gradual process, I don't know, but there's all kinds of fossils in there, including a lot of soft-body forms. But anyhow, we have these rocks. Of course, it doesn't take long to form a rock if you have the right kind of cement, or if it's buried deep enough, it'll form very rapidly. Well, anyhow, we have these Cambrian rocks, which evolutionists believe were laid down beginning about 600 million years ago over a stretch of some millions of years. Now, in that Cambrian, in those Cambrian rocks, you find a tremendous number of very highly complex forms of life. Now, may we have that first slide, and someone will switch off the lights, please. Now, here on this first slide, we see the representative of the types of animals found in the Cambrian rocks. This slide was obtained from the American Museum of Natural History. In these Cambrian rocks, for example, we find the trilobites. The trilobites are very complex creatures, extremely complex. In addition to trilobites, we find the sea urchin. We find the branching sponges, find the swimming crustacean, Cydnia. We find sea cucumbers. We find the jellyfish, brachiopods, and a tremendous variety of very highly complex forms of life. Now, billions upon billions of these fossils have been found, scattered over various places around the Earth. The fact is, they're found on every continent of the Earth. They are so complex in their structures that evolutionary biologists, estimate that their evolution would have required at least several billion years, about 3 billion years or so. Now, we think the so-called random processes involved in evolution could never give rise to any complex creatures like that in 3 billion years. We think the laws of probability would require billions of times 3 billion years for the origin of these creatures. But this is the assumption made by evolutionary biologists. Now, we have this tremendous variety of very complex creatures in these Cambrian rocks. Now, if they have arisen slowly and gradually over billions of years of time, then the pre-Cambrian rocks must have a tremendous fossil record. Pre-Cambrian rocks, we ought to find the evolutionary ancestors of the trilobites and of the sea urchins and of the jellyfish and of these various crustaceans and mollusks and so forth that exist in these Cambrian rocks. Hundreds of these species had hard parts. Now, one thing is certain, if they evolved, they all didn't invent hard parts at the same time. Those hard parts would have been evolving over tens of millions of years. Furthermore, their very life existence is dependent upon those hard parts. They're an integral part of the organism. The idea that these animals could have evolved directly from soft-bodied animals is absolutely incredible. In any case, we do find fossils of soft-bodied forms, the jellyfish and worms and so forth and so on. If these creatures evolved in the pre-Cambrian rocks should be rich in fossils. What do we actually find in the pre-Cambrian rocks? Not one single indisputable multicellular fossil has ever been found in one of these so-called pre-Cambrian rocks. Not one. Now, there have been reports of microscopic single-cell organisms in pre-Cambrian rocks, bacteria and algae. I think it's questionable that you can identify anything of that kind in any rock. But let us assume that these are really genuine fossils of bacteria and algae. Well, that leaves a monumental gap, you see, between these microscopic single-cell organisms and these very highly complex creatures that we find in the Cambrian. A gap of several billion years, as a matter of fact. If you can find fossils of microscopic, soft-bodied, single-celled algae and bacteria, you certainly shouldn't have any problem finding all the intermediates in between. But not one single such form has ever been found. George Gaillard Simpson has characterized the pre-Cambrian fossils as a major mystery of the history of life. Well, I've got news for Simpson. It may be a mystery to him, but it's no mystery to the creationists. This abrupt appearance of these highly complex forms of life, the absence of any ancestors whatsoever, is just what we would predict on the basis of creation. Certainly we can say that no one has ever found the ancestors of these creatures. Furthermore, we notice that they're very different from one another. The trilobite is very different from a jellyfish. They're very different from a sea urchin. They're all different from a brachiopod. There's absolutely no evidence in the fossil record of any transitional form. None at all. No evidence that they arose from a common ancestor. Jellyfish has always been a jellyfish. Trilobite has always been a trilobite. And a worm has always been a worm, right from the beginning. They are distinctly set apart with no transitional forms, again, just as expected on the basis of creation. Now, one of these invertebrates supposedly evolved into the vertebrates. The first vertebrate was supposed to be a fish. And this transition is believed to have required 100 million years. Now, that's a rather remarkable change from a soft-bodied form or from an invertebrate with soft inner parts and hard outer parts, or exoskeleton or shell, evolving into a vertebrate, an animal with an internal skeleton and soft outer parts. Quite a transition. Should be tremendous documentation for this in the fossil record. What does the fossil record actually reveal? not one single intermediate form between the invertebrates and the vertebrates have ever been found. Not one. Just think of the billions times billions times billions of these creatures that would have lived and died during all that 100 million years, and yet one has never been discovered as a fossil. Again, we believe that this indicates that the fishes and all of the vertebrates were separately created by God rather than having evolved. May we have that next slide, please? Or do I have the control here? Here we are. All right. Now, here on this slide, we see the fish that is supposed to have evolved into the amphibian. Oh, yes, I want to say something more about the fishes, by the way. The major kinds of fishes appear abruptly in the fossil record with no transitional form. For example, I have with me a paper published in the Proceedings of the Linnaean Society of London, Volume 177, January 1966. The title of the article is A Little on Lungfishes. It was the presidential address by Dr. Errol White on the occasion of his election as president of that society. Dr. White is an evolutionist. The society is overwhelming evolutionist. Listen to what this man has to say in that article on page 8. He says, quote, "But whatever ideas authorities may have on the subject, the lungfishes, like every other major group of fishes that I know, have their origins firmly based in nothing." And he italicizes the word nothing to emphasize it. The major kinds of fishes appear abruptly, no ancestors. A little later in the article, on that same page, he says, "I have often thought how little I should like to have to prove organic evolution in a court of law." And then finally he says, quote, "We still do not know the mechanics of evolution in spite of the overconfident claims in some quarters, nor are we likely to make further progress in this by the classical methods of paleontology or biology, and we shall certainly not advance matters by jumping up and down shrilling Darwin is God and I, so-and-so, am his prophet," unquote. Well, that's some interesting statements, isn't it, by an evolutionist? But Dr. White puts it right on the line. These major fish kinds appear abruptly with no ancestors. All right, here's the fish, then, supposedly gave rise to the amphibian. Now, in the lower portion of the slide, you see the amphibian, which is supposed to be the world's oldest amphibian. I took these illustrations from the book on Vertebrate Paleontology, 3rd edition, by Dr. A.S. Romer. He said this is the world's oldest amphibian. Here's the Cossopterygian fish. Evolutionists believe the Cossopterygian fish was the fish that evolved into the amphibian. Why did they pick this particular fish? Well, he was a lungfish, but that's not definitive because there are many lungfishes, fishes that live today. Some fishes are, lungfishes are in existence today. But their anatomy is totally unsuitable. But they picked this particular fish because there are some bones in the fins, you see, that evolutionists maintain could have evolved into feet and legs. Of course, you'll notice that he has three other fins which also had bones, but apparently he found some way to get rid of those, leaving these others to evolve into the feet and legs. In addition to this, there's some similarities in the vertebrae and some similarities in the skull pattern. There's many dissimilarities in the skull pattern as well. But it's on the basis of this very scanty evidence that evolutionists have selected that fish, the Cossopterygian, as the ancestor of the amphibian. But I want you to notice the tremendous difference between that fish and that amphibian. That fish was a fish. He had a lovely set of fish fins, highly designed or adapted for balancing, steering, locomotion in the water. On the other hand, this amphibian has a basic amphibian limb, feet and legs, and there's not one single transitional form documenting the transition of those fins and those feet and legs. Not one single such transitional form. And there's another basic difference that we can notice between the fish and the amphibian. Notice the cross-section of the fish at the pelvic region. The fins serve only for balancing and steering. The pelvic bones are small and loosely embedded in muscle. There's no connection between the pelvic bones of the fish and the vertebral column, fossil or living. You don't need any connections. the fins do not support the weight of the body. There is no such thing as a walking fish. Today, or in the fossil record, there's no connection between the fins and the vertebral column. The fins cannot support the weight of the body. The walking catfish of Florida do not walk. They slither along on their belly, using the same type of motion they use in the water. They have to. That's the only kind of muscles they got. Once in a while, they can stand up on their tail and flip head over heel, so to speak, and make a few feet at a time. As long as they're out of the water and their gills are moist, they can absorb oxygen through their gills. But they do not walk. Now, take a look, on the other hand, at the amphibian. The limbs do support the weight of the body. The pelvic bones are enlarged and firmly attached to the vertebral column. Now, that's the kind of anatomy you must have in order to walk. That's the kind of anatomy possessed by all amphibians, living or fossil, and there are no intermediate forms at all. Now, if you don't have intermediate forms, what do you do? Well, this problem was solved by the American Museum of Natural History, shown in the next slide. Here's an exhibit found in the Chicago Museum of Natural History. And the previous slide I also obtained from an exhibit. Here it is, right here in this exhibit. Now, notice, here is the Crotsotherigian fish. Here is the amphibian, and in between is a remarkable transitional form, half fish and half amphibian. Now, I'm sure people go by that exhibit and take a quick glance and say, why, marvelous proof for evolution. Isn't that remarkable? They don't take time to read the fine print under the intermediate form to find that it's labeled inferred intermediate. Inferred, indeed, is strictly imaginary. Who created the transitional form? Their artists. In this great collection of fossils, they could find no transitional form, so they gave the job to their artist. Isn't that remarkable? With all that evolution, millions of years, they ought to find some transitional form, but none are found. Now, another interesting aspect of this story is the fact that the fish that supposedly gave rise to the amphibian was believed to have become extinct about 70 million years or so ago, because in rocks, supposedly 70 million years or younger, no fossils had been found of that fish. So they assumed it died out or became extinct. In 1939, they found this fish to be alive and well off the coast of Africa. And here is one of these specimens, and there he is, ladies and gentlemen, your ancestor. But he's still the same old fish, and that's remarkable. Some of his cousins evolved all the way to man while he remained the same old fish. Now, that's remarkable, isn't it? Also, it's quite remarkable that something could be around 70 million years and not leave a fossil. Some invertebrates believed to have become extinct 300 million years ago have been found recently still alive and well. I think there must be something wrong with their many millions of years. Now, here's the animals believed to have been ancestral to the dinosaurs, birds, and flying reptiles. Now, we're going to take a quick look at dinosaurs. Then we're going to consider the origin of flight, which should be an ideal test case for evolution versus creation, because the evolution from land animal to flying animal would require a remarkable transition, which we should be able to identify quite readily. And flight occurs in four different classes of animals: the birds, insects, flying reptiles, now extinct, and mammals, or the bats. Therefore, we should have multiplied opportunities to find transitional form. Well, before we take a look at flight, we want to take a look at the dinosaurs. Here's a Triceratops dinosaur. Notice that he has three horns, so he's called Triceratops, the three-horned face. Has three horns, two above the orbit, one on the nose. And in addition to these spikes, or horns, he has this mammoth armor shield. Bone several inches thick, so he's armored and he's prepared for battle with a sword all ready to go. No doubt he would have presented a formidable foe to some Allosaurus or Tyrannosaurus who sought to devour him. But these features are remarkably different than his so-called reptilian ancestor. But these horned dinosaurs appear abruptly in the fossil record with their horns complete and their armor complete, and no intermediate forms are found, just as we'd expect if they had been created. Now, here's Stegosaurus, quite a different kind of a dinosaur. Notice, instead of that huge head with all that armor plate, he's got this little head. Poor little fellow got all mixed up in his evolution, and the spikes end up out here on the tail rather than on the head. But actually, With the kind of head he's got, that's where these spikes would be the most effective. Can you imagine what kind of a weapon that tail must have been? He flung that tail around and could sink those spikes into the flanks of a Tyrannosaurus or something like that, and perhaps escape. In addition to these, by the way, the spikes were 3 feet long, 6 inches at the base. In addition to these spikes, he had these plates running along the back. Now, they were either heat exchangers or armor plates. Nobody knows just what. But they were very, very different. These were unique structures. And these plated and spiked dinosaurs, again, appear abruptly in the fossil record with no intermediate form. Here's the Trachodon dinosaur. This is a representative of the duckbill dinosaurs. The front portion of his jaw had no teeth, but were composed of horny material, just like somewhat like the duck bill of a duck. Can you imagine that? A dinosaur walking around with a duck bill. Not only did he have the duck bill, he had webbed feet and a very powerful swimming tail. No doubt spent a lot of time in the water, munching the tender vegetation that grew there. In the back of his jaw, he had teeth, all right. He had 2,000 teeth in the back part of the jaw, 500 on each lower jaw, 500 on each upper, piled one on top of the other. As some wore out or fell out, he had a ready replacement. But these horned, or these duck-billed dinosaurs, again, appear abruptly with no intermediate form. Here's the Allosaurus, a mammoth carnivorous dinosaur standing about 18 feet tall, having a head about 2.5 feet long. The teeth were about 3 inches long. He was a ferocious meat-eating dinosaur. The mighty meat-eating dinosaur of all was a Tyrannosaurus rex. His head was about 5 feet long. He had teeth 6 inches long and claws about 8 inches long. A ferocious meat-eating dinosaur. These dinosaurs, again, appear without any series of transitional form leading from some other creature. Now, here's the Brontosaurus. Most of us assume the Brontosaurus is the biggest dinosaur of all. That's because that's the one we usually see in the museum. He was quite big, a monster, really, 40 tons of steaks, roasts, and hamburger, walking around on 4 feet. About 80 feet long, quite a monstrous creature, but he's not the champion of all. The champion of all is the Brachiosaurus. This creature weighed 80 to 90 tons. In addition to his huge bulk, he had this very long neck. And he had another peculiar feature. On the top of his head, he had a bony dome where you find the nostrils. I guess he could raise his head like a periscope and breathe, you see, and without worrying about some meat-eating dinosaur grabbing a hold of his neck. But this creature, with his long neck, appears abruptly without any intermediate forms. Now, all of those dinosaurs appear abruptly in the fossil record without intermediate forms, as expected on the basis of creation. Here's a Dimetrodon, a strange reptile with this very unusual sail. Again, he appears abruptly without any intermediate form. Now, going back to our story on the origin of flight, we see again the so-called ancestor of birds and flying reptiles. Now, first we want to consider the flying reptile. Here's one of the flying reptiles. In the lower portion of the slide, you see a pteranodon. This reptile had no teeth. He had a long, toothless beak, about 3 feet long, very long bony crest. And in this case, the fourth finger, which you see, is tremendously lengthened. The first three fingers have remained the normal length, but according to evolutionary theory, the fourth finger got longer and longer and longer through many millions of years of time. Very unusual, very different. But we do not find a single transitional stage showing the origin of this flying reptile. Not a trace of an intermediate stage. Now, the same is true of the flying insects. There are no intermediate forms. The same is true of the bird. Archaeopteryx, the oldest bird, supposedly, appears abruptly in the fossil record, completely feathered, a bird with no intermediate forms. And finally, the bats appear fully formed, with no intermediate forms. In every case, then, in the flying animals, we find the sudden appearance of these creatures with no intermediate form, precisely as predicted on the basis of creation. So we see, then, that the fossil record itself, rather than supporting evolution, contradicts the basic predictions of evolutionary theory and supports in a remarkable way the concept of direct spatial creation. All right, now we want to go back to these in a little more detail. This pteranodon, fossils of that creature, have been found recently with a wingspread up to 52 feet. Isn't that remarkable? The wingspan of an F-4 Phantom jet is only at 38 feet. That means this creature had a wingspread 14 feet longer than the F-4 Phantom jet. Now, I don't know about you people, but I'm glad that critter is extinct. Recently, this creature with this huge wingspread has been found down in the state of Texas, of course. Where else? Everything in Texas is always the biggest. You know, I heard recently there's a couple of Texans went up to Alaska, and they were spouting off and being obnoxious. Finally, one of the Alaskans got disgusted with him and said, "Now look, you guys, if you don't shut up, we're going to cut Alaska in half, and then Texas is going to be the third largest state." Here is a different type of flying reptile, the Rhomphorhynchus. Had a very long tail with a rudder, very large keel for anchoring the flight muscles. Again, he had this very long fourth finger, which supposedly evolved over hundreds, or say tens of millions of years, gradually getting longer and longer, all by these random accidental chance mutations. At the same time, other random chance mutations generated the wing membrane, the flight muscles, the hollow bone, and we had this marvelous flying machine. But not one single intermediate has ever been found. These flying animals appear abruptly in the fossil record without intermediate stages, just as predicted on the basis of creation. Now here's Archaeopteryx, supposed to be the world's oldest known bird. Now, we noticed that he was indeed a bird. He had wings, he had feathers. By the way, those feathers are identical, or were identical, to the feathers on a modern bird. And feathers are incredibly complex structures. These feathers appear absolutely complete in this bird, with no intermediate forms, nowhere on the face of the earth has any transitional forms been found. This bird was a bird indeed. Perching feet, a bird-like skull, he was a bird. Now, some have claimed, of course, that he has reptilian features, or they identify some of his features as being reptilian, or having been inherited from a reptilian ancestor. This bird, for example, had vertebrae extending out along the tail, unlike modern birds. He had teeth, also unlike modern birds, and he had claws on the wings. And these are supposed to be some of his reptilian characteristics. Now, let me point out, first of all, that while it is true that modern birds do not have teeth, it is also true that there were ancient birds which had no teeth. Some of these ancient birds did have teeth, but there were other ancient birds that appear abruptly in the fossil record that had no teeth. The significant thing is that there's no intermediate stages, none whatsoever. Some ancient birds had teeth and some didn't. That makes them just the same as all of the other subclasses of vertebrates. Some fishes have teeth, but some do not. Many amphibians have teeth, but many do not. Some reptiles have teeth, but some do not. Most mammals have teeth, but some do not. Most of you have teeth, but some do not. This is the characteristic of every subclass of vertebrates. It's not peculiar to birds. It's true of all the subclasses of the vertebrates. Now, concerning the presence of the claws, we find that there are several birds today that have claws. Here's the Powhatan, a bird living in South America today. Very good bird, as you can see. This bird has claws. The juvenile Powhatan, as you will notice, has two claws. Now, if you could find that bird as a fossil, I'm sure someone would claim he's a transitional form. But he is a bird very much alive and well today. He's not the only bird that has claws. The Tarraco of Africa has claws, and the ostrich has three claws, which, if you chose to do so, could say were more reptile-like than the claws of Archaeopteryx. But again, the ostrich is a bird alive and well today. Now, Archaeopteryx, you see, was definitely a bird. Let me quote from the book Biology and Comparative Physiology of Birds, edited by A.J. Marshall, published by Academic Press of New York in 1960. In Volume 1, we find Chapter 1 was written by Dr. W.E. Swinton. Swinton is an evolutionist, professor at Toronto University, an expert on birds. On page 1, Dr. Swinton says, quote,
The origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages through which the remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved. Unquote. So he says there is no fossil evidence then for this change from reptile to bird. You have to deduce it from the birds and reptiles, but no intermediate forms in the fossil record. Now, the same is true of insects. Evolutionists do not know what on an insect gave rise to wings. There is a dispute, a controversy about this today. If you could find one single intermediate form, that would settle the controversy. But the controversy still rages because no such intermediate form has ever been found. We have no intermediate forms in the case of the birds, of the reptiles, of the insects. What about the mammals? Well, here's a picture of a fossil bat. And we see that in the bat, not one but four fingers have supposedly evolved slowly and gradually through millions of years of time. While all this was going on, somehow the wing membrane regenerated, the flight muscles, and other changes required to convert a non-flying mammal into a flying mammal took place over millions of years of time. Therefore, we ought to have a lot of transitional forms. Let's see what we can find. Well, here in this slide, we see a picture of the world's oldest known bat taken from the cover page of Science, December 9, 1966. That is, this is the world's oldest bat, according to evolutionists. The article accompanying this picture said that this bat was found in rocks 50 million years old. And they said no fossil related to a bat any older than this has ever been found. So here's the oldest fossil bat or anything related to a bat that has ever been found. Now, in the center of the picture, you see the actual bones that were discovered in the rocks. And then if the bones were stretched out and clothed with flesh, you see what the bat would have looked like. All right, according to evolutionists, then, here he is, the world's oldest known bat. And what is he? 100% bat. The first evidence of flight in mammals occurs in fully developed bats, and there are no intermediate forms. Now, here in the origin of flight, now may I have the light, please? Here in the origin of flight, we have the best chance of finding the intermediate forms because they'd be so easy to identify. And with four long evolutionary series, we should have multiplied opportunities to find transitional forms, but none are found. Particularly where a creature is distinctly different, where it would be easy to identify the transitional forms, that is where, beyond a shadow of a doubt, no transitional forms are found. We believe then, when all of this evidence is carefully considered and is objectively evaluated, we find that the evidence does fit predictions based upon creation. But it does contradict, on the other hand, the predictions based upon evolutionary theory. All right. Yes, sir. Yes.
When you listen to you talk about Romer, I seem to think that Romer is pretty well accepted among the evolutionists today. And in his textbook, Comparative Anatomy, I seem to remember he was talking about the development of legs on fish. And the theory that he proposed was that there were a lot of droughts. These fish began to crawl out of the lake and look for food.
Okay.
Are there any arguments other than the bone structure that you talked about on that?
Well, a lot of evolutionists don't buy that idea at all. As has been suggested, Romer thought that what the mechanism whereby fish evolved in amphibians, there were droughts. And these poor little fishes found themselves in a mud hole. Water was drying up, and so they said to themselves, now if I'm going to survive, I got to get on the ball and get out of this mud hole and go find some water somewhere. Now, most of them didn't make it, but just by pure chance, a few of these creatures had inherited some change. Now, it has to be extremely slight, you see, that somehow enabled them to traverse the ground a little bit better than the others, and they made it. And then the rains came, and they went back to the sea and competed with the fishes again for another 1,000 years or so, or 100 years or so, or more, who knows. And then another drought came along, and so it repeated itself over and over again. And finally, the amphibians evolved. Now, the problem with that kind of an idea is this. In the first place, the change would be extremely slight. They'd have an extremely slight advantage. But after the drought was over with, after they're back into the river or the lake or the ocean, wherever they came from, what do they have to compete with? Fishes. And how are they going to survive? Being better fishes. What they need to survive is something that's going to make them be a better fish. They cannot afford to wait 30 million years until they're amphibians. What they need to survive, they need right now. What do they need right now? Something that would help them to compete with other fishes. And if you get a halfway amphibian and a halfway fish, he's not a very good either. And he's not going to survive competing with fishes. But he's not an amphibian yet. He's not out there on land. And furthermore, back there when you're supposed to have all these droughts, back there in the Devonian, you do find the fishes and you find the amphibians. Oh, there's so many things wrong with that story that there's a lot of evolutionists who won't buy it. It's the important thing here, if you're going to have some change that's going to help you to survive and compete, you have to have it that will enable you to survive in the environment in which you're going to find yourself, not some potential environment. And the environment those things would find themselves in after the drought was over was not out on land. They'd be back in the water competing with fishes. Of course, there's no record of the transition. And there's other problems wrong. The lungfishes, as far as I have ever been able to determine, the present lungfishes never leave the water. When the water becomes stagnant, they will go to the surface and gulp some air. There are the true lungfishes, the dipnoi, and these were not dipnoi. These are not the true lungfishes. The true lungfishes, there are some in existence today. When their body of water dries up and they find themselves in a mud hole, they do not leave the water. They're a little bit smarter than evolutionists. They know the only chance to survive is to bury themselves in the mud. They wrap themselves up into a ball. Some of them actually construct a tough cocoon-like membrane to prevent water loss. And they remain there, absolutely motionless, breathing just enough air to stay alive. They can stay that way for several months, up to several years. Then when the water comes in, they break out of that mud, snort a couple times, and go swimming happily off through the water. They do not leave the water. Let me take the hand way up there in the corner. Yes.
On the subject of races, Dr. Morris suggested that there was a horizontal evolution in terms of accommodations. What I would like to know is this. How did the Oriental features contribute to survival in that environment? Why was it necessary? I could see the black.
The creationists are not. The question is as to the origin of races. Say there's been some horizontal variation, limited variation within the kind, and with it, in this case within the human species. How did any of these features have any selective value? Say the Oriental features. We don't believe they did. We don't believe they come about by any selection, natural selection. How did these races come about? Now, first of all, before the flood, the humans were intermarrying freely. There was free gene flow. You'll never have any race or variety arise when there's free gene flow. You take all the varieties of dogs, and you throw all these dogs out in the wild. Pretty soon you won't have a collie. You won't have a chihuahua. You won't have a St. Bernard. They're all going to be a mongrel dog. They're all going to intermix. And you're going to have a mongrel dog. You could never have these varieties unless they were separated, reproductively separated from one another. But this was not possible before the flood. Now, what happened after the flood? Again, they were not isolated from one another. They were freely intermarrying and mixing. But then at the time of, well, let me say, first of all, that in the human race, the species, there were these incipient racial characteristics. Some people tend to be a little bit darker than others. Some tend to have the oriental features. Some tend to be the blue-eyed blondes and so forth. There were these features, as you could find in a mongrel dog, as man did find in the mongrel population. He saw these different genetic traits. Well, you'd find these different genetic traits in the human population at this time. But they were not isolated from one another. They were freely intermarrying, so they were all mixed up. Now, I believe at the time of the flood, that God worked in such a way that the the three sons and the three daughter-in-laws of Noah were racially mixed. In other words, Noah and his wife were racially mixed, as were the parents of the three daughter-in-laws. Actually, you had eight people then contributing to the gene pool following the flood. Noah and his wife and the six parents of the three daughter-in-laws. That's eight people. Now, in eight people, you have plenty of genetic variability. Tremendous amount of genetic variability, almost infinite genetic variability in eight people, providing that they are not pure strains. Now, if you had eight blonde, blue-eyed Caucasians, you'd never get blacks out of that. But these were racially mixed. Now, what happened after the flood? Well, at the time of Babel, God confounded the languages, scattered these people in small groups. Now, we do not know whether he did it or not, but it's very possible that he confounded the languages in such a way that he gave a common language to those who had these incipient racial characteristics for the blacks. He did it the same thing for those who had the incipient characteristic of the Orientals, same for the blue-eyed, blonde Scandinavians, and so forth. He scattered these people in small groups. They were now reproductively isolated. They intermarried. They became highly inbred, and these racial characteristics surfaced rapidly. They were now isolated from one another by language barriers, and soon by geographical barriers. And so, by this means, then, the races have arisen. Now, natural selection had nothing to do with it. Why do we find blacks in Africa? Because they migrated to Africa because their black skin did suit them for that environment. It was not suitable for the blonde, blue-eyed Scandinavians. They get blistered and sunburned down there. They naturally migrated up into the northern clime, which was more hospitable to their skin and so forth. Did you have another related question?
If those genes were inherent in all eight people from the
yard,
there are recessive and dominant genes, and do not dominant genes overtake a recessive gene, so that if you have a blue-eyed blonde characteristic, you would need two of the kind in order to...
The dominant versus the recessive, the only way you can have a blue-eyed person, that person must be homozygous for the blue gene. If he has one brown gene, he's going to be brown-eyed. Yes, you would have to have, the separation would have to be quite selective. It would have to be so, separation would have to be so selective that, say, in the blonde, blue-eyed Scandinavian group, that at least a very high preponderance of the recessive blue genes went with that group. Now, there are some brown-eyed Scandinavians and black-eyed and so forth, so I suppose it was not quite that clear-cut. Yes, where the gene is dominant, if you're going to have a recessive trait, God would have to operate in such a way that he'd have a high proportion of these recessive genetic factors in that population. Now, if you read the 30th and 31st chapter of Genesis, you see how God did that with the goats and with the cattle, with the sheep, in the case of Jacob and Laban, where Jacob thought he was really clever, where he worked up some scheme, so he got all these speckled and spotted cattle and sheep and goats and so forth. He led them to breed before the stakes that had been striped and so forth, and he thought, boy, he was bringing about this prenatal influence, you see. And people have accused the Bible of being ignorant of genetics, you know. It's the Bible writer sure didn't know anything about genetics, because of course this would have no effect, and it wouldn't. But if you read in the 31st chapter, you see that God tells Jacob, your scheme had nothing to do with this. Laban had cheated you. I wanted to bless you. So God operated in such a way that those speckled and spotted sheep and goats and so forth, which had recessive genes, which ordinarily would breed very few. I mean, ordinarily the population would breed very few speckled and spotted sheep and goats. But God operated in such a way that he brought the goats and sheep carrying the recessive genes together, and so that they bred in such a way that they gave rise to an artificially higher proportion of these recessive characteristics. And therefore, in the goats and sheep, got a lot of speckled and spotted that you would not ordinarily get. And that caused Jacob to prosper. Read that story in the 30th and 31st chapter of Genesis. Very, very interesting. Yes, back there.
How would evolution account for, in the transition to flight, the transition from cells to feathers and from solid bones to hollow bones?
Well, they just say for some reason the change was selective. Now, how it was, I don't have the slightest idea. You know, you had all kinds of suggestions on how scales changed into feathers. One guy suggested these reptiles were jumping around and they frayed the scales and this changed into feathers. Now, what frayed scales, how that would force change into feathers, I don't... But somebody really seriously suggested that. Nobody knows. Nobody can say one shred, one iota about how scales change into feathers. There's not one single bit of evidence for it. And how a scale would gradually change into a feather, I don't know. Some believe that they first climbed the trees and then they begin to jump and glide. Others say, no, they ran along the ground and they finally evolved wings. And there's this big controversy raging today. Was the animal that evolved in the bird, was in arboreal form? That is, did he dwell in the trees or was he a form that ran along the ground? They don't know. They don't have the foggiest notion. Yes, let me take that hand back there.
What is the evolutionist's best explanation for the systematic gap? What's your answer to that?
What is the best evolutionist, what is the best explanation the evolutionist can make for the gaps in the fossil record? Now, Kitsch doesn't even try. As I mentioned, Goldschmidt says this hope for monster mechanism that you wouldn't expect any transitional forms because they weren't any. The bird just abruptly comes from a reptile, something like that. Others have suggested other ideas. Simpson, George Gaynard Simpson, his idea is this, that animals would go along for many millions of years of time with no change, and then they would abruptly evolve explosively over a very short period of time. Well, I say very short periods of time. What does he mean by a short period of time? Well, 3 or 4 or 5 million years instead of 100 million years. That's what he means by explosive evolution. Why for evolution? Well, let me say, first of all, there's not one shred of empirical evidence for this one way or the other. There's we don't see anything like this happening today, that some creature suddenly begins to mutate rapidly or something like that, and we don't see anything like that happening today. And if you had something like this, say it took place in 5 million years instead of 100 million years. Well, 5 million years, that's a long time. My, you could leave an awful lot of fossils in 5 million years. What is the only evidence Simpson has for this? The gaps in the fossil record. That's the only evidence. But he says that you had these rapid bursts of evolution. What's the documentation for his rapid burst of evolution? The gaps in the fossil record. In fact, you can't find the transitional forms. That's his explanation. Others have suggested the hopeful monster mechanism, Simpson's rapid burst of evolution, things like that. Others are suggesting that there was evolution in the control genes, in the control mechanisms. And that's how you had to have not mutations in structural genes, but you had to have mutations in control mechanisms. This would give you more rapid evolution. Well, my, when you've got a mechanism like that, you have got some real problem. You've got all these complexes of genes governing a single characteristic. Some of these genes are found on different chromosomes. And you've got to have a mutation, which is a random change in this control mechanism, such that it can changes the control mechanisms in a directive and a purposeful, or at least a beneficial way. Why, that's absolutely incredible. Yes.
In your discussion of flight, in my mind, how does an evolutionist explain a flightless bird? How could that be adapted?
Well, you see what they say, the birds, now most evolution today believe that flightless birds came from birds that flew. And they went all through this mechanism and trouble evolving wings, and then for some reason they went all through all the trouble to lose them again. I don't know how they explain it. There's no explanation. And same thing about a whale and marine reptiles and marine mammals. These things went through all this millions of years of evolution to evolve the ability to live on land. And after they got on land, they decided they went back in the water again, and they evolved back in the water. Because you have the whales and everything, they're mammals living in water, and supposedly evolved from land mammals. And the marine reptiles supposedly evolved from land reptiles, although in neither case, a marine reptile or marine mammal, do you find any single transitional form? Yes, sir.
What was the purpose of defense mechanisms on dinosaurs and stegosaurus?
Defense mechanism. What was the purpose of a defense mechanism on dinosaurs and other creatures? Now, if there were any other purposes for these structures, before death and so forth came to the world, I don't know what they were. Now, then why did these creatures have these defense mechanisms if they did so exist before death entered into the world? That, you see, is a problem. Now, some have suggested that when the Bible says death entered into the world, that that meant only for humans. Now, some argue strenuously against that suggestion, say, well, death means death, and that means all animals. Well, then we are left with the problem of these defense mechanisms, of these armor. There were armored fishes. Why did these fishes have armor? That's the problem for evolutionists, too. Because they say, well, here, they were the first vertebrates, they were the first vertebrates, and they had armor. Now, if they were the only fishes around, what were eating them? Why did they have that armor? If there weren't some creatures around to eat them, you see. Well, that's a problem for evolutionists, too. But it's a problem for the creationists. Now, it seems to me that we may come around to this viewpoint that there was death in the world before the fall of man, but not for man, but for animals. Why did the bombardier beetle have his remarkable defense mechanism if there were no things around eating beetles? Why did these dinosaurs have this armor and this defense mechanism if there's nothing around eating dinosaurs? You see, I don't know. Yes.
In the Cambrian layer, you find, I think, every order of non-vertebrates, but yet no vertebrates are found. When you go to orders above that, Silurian, Devonian, Carboniferous zones, you still do not find modern animals such as the bear, the goat.
You don't find mammals in Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, and so forth. That's right. Now, I think Dr. Morris has gone over this once. Maybe we ought to go over it a few more times. We believe the distribution of these fossils is explicable on the basis of geography, ecology, mobility, and hydrodynamic shorting. First of all, these caiman animals were bottom feeders. They're animals that live and feed on the bottom. The fishes are mobile. They live at higher elevation. If you're going to have a tremendous flood, where you bring a tremendous amount of sediment, suddenly sweeps in, the first thing would bury would be the bottom feeders, the creatures found on that level. And then they would overwhelm the fishes. The amphibians would be overwhelmed at the water-land boundary. And the mammals the reptiles in their area, mammals in theirs and so forth, the more mobile creature would tend to escape. And then there would be the matter of sorting, hydrodynamic sorting, and things like this. Now, the separation, by the way, is not as clear-cut as people would have you believe. They have found recently remains of fishes in early Ordovician. That's immediately after the so-called Cambrian. Now, if you've got these fishes complete and intact in the... Let's assume that the Cambrian really was a time zone and the Ordovician was the next time zone. If you have fishes complete in early Ordovician, what does that mean? They had to be around the Cambrian too, didn't they? They didn't, bingo, just come into existence like that if they evolved. If you've got a fish complete in early Ordovician, that means he was evolving for millions of years of time. That means he was evolving down in the Cambrian. That means you did have fishes down in the Cambrian. But they haven't found it for some reason. What's the explanation? The explanation of the evolutionists must be precisely what the creationists give, ecological, zonation. As a matter of fact, this is precisely what Daniel Axelrod says. Why do you find simple plants in early Devonian, more complex plants in middle Devonian, and the vascular plants in late Devonian, while vascular plants were in existence all of this time, including the Cambrian? Well, the early Devonian deposits, he said, represent lowland deposits. And the only reason you don't find the vascular plants in these early Devonian deposits is because at that time, of course, he believes the early Devonian would represent that true time period. But why don't you find vascular plants in these early Devonian deposits if they were in existence? Because they were in the uplands. And the late Devonian deposits where you find these vascular plants, they just so happen to represent upland deposits. And so he is using an ecological zone idea to explain these problems, just like creationists do. Geographical. You're going to find certain animals in certain geographical zones and not in others. You're going to find fishes in the marine environment, ecological. You're going to find fishes in Cambrian. I mean, you're going to find these Cambrian animals because the Cambrian represents the marine. It represents the lowland or the bottom. You're going to find fishes in the Ordovician and Silurian because that represents, again, the Cambrian. It represents the marine or the water deposits. You're going to find the amphibians in the waterland boundaries. That's the ecological. And there's the geographical. There is the hydrodynamic sorting involved in the way these things are sorted out. Get the book, The Genesis Flood by Dr. Morris, and read that book for the details. I think you, at least you'll find that book extremely interesting. It's loaded with evidences. Now, let's see. Well, it's a few minutes after. Let's take about one more. Let me take this question.
I thought of two examples that don't bother me, but I can imagine evolution in this. The metamorphosis of a tadpole to a frog, if you were an evolutionist, it seems to be a beautiful example of a reverse evolution. Likewise, the development of clines, the development of clines in populations would also seem to be a good example of reverse isolation, because after the clines is set up, the plants will not, or plants or animals or whatever, will not maybe grow in the same locations then when you try to interchange.
You mean they've been the competition excluded by competitive factors or something?
Well, the example of the yarrow that is found at different altitudes in California. If you take a low altitude plant and try to plant it in a high altitude location, it won't be very successful or will dry out. Take a high altitude plant and grow it. At low altitudes, it won't grow quite as well, but would grow. Something like that.
Yes, there's some differences in the ability of plants. You know, they each seek out its own ecological zone conditions. Right. That's true. But this does not explain how one basic plant changed into another. There are different plants with different genetic characters. Even among humans, some humans can exist or perhaps exist more readily under certain conditions than you and I can. But there are these limited genetic differences. Now, about the tadpole to the fish, or fish to tadpole, rather. I'm sorry, you go from the tadpole to the frog. Now, I've never seen any evolutionists, I've never heard any knowledgeable, well-known evolutionists ever cite the example of the tadpole to the frog as being evidence for evolution. It is metamorphosis. And as a matter of fact, it's a remarkable thing for evolutionists to explain. The fins or whatever you have on the tadpole disappear and legs appear from an entirely different tissue. The gills are resorbed and the lungs develop from an entirely different tissue. The gills do not evolve into lungs, anything like that. Then you have the case of the butterfly or a moth where you have the egg which then goes to the larva stage. And the larva goes into a cocoon, becomes this jelly-like mass, and emerges as a beautiful butterfly, something like that. How do you explain that? It's a crawling animal. It had to evolve all the mechanism to crawl. And then while maintaining this mechanism to crawl, somehow it evolved the mechanism to fly. Marvelous. Wonderful. Wonder who thought of that idea. I doubt if evolution could think of it. Let's see. All right, one more quick question, Bob.
Have you heard any explanation by evolutionists on why we've got different sexes?
The origin of sex, well, nobody really knows. And they think they had detected the origin of sex in these microorganisms from fossils a billion years old. The man who published that retracted that publication, by the way. He realized that there are changes that take place during fossilization that would look like that had nothing to do with this. You're supposed to have the asexual microorganisms, sexual microorganisms, where they do combine, mix their genetic material, then divide. But the process, of course, from then on, is who can explain it? I don't know. You pin an evolutionist down on any of these things. Tell them how. Give them a nice description, step by step, how eyes evolve, things like that. Just what happened? Why did it happen? What was the selective factor work? You pin him. He won't have anything to say. I'm sure of that. All right, we better take some time off.